Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Costco Business Center, offering delivery to Anchorage Air Cargo companies for shipments to rural Alaska for business and home. More at CostcoBusinessDelivery.com.
Hello, and welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. HIV and AIDS diagnoses have decreased by 8% in the U.S. In Alaska, there are approximately 700 people living with this disease. Advancements in medicine over the last 40 years has changed the way that HIV and AIDS is treated and prevented, leading to decreasing transmission rates. By also decreasing the associated stigma and shame of diagnosis, we can better serve those living with the disease while continuing to decrease and eliminate its incidence. The Alaskan AIDS Assistance Association is a nonprofit organization that commits to supporting and empowering people living with or affected by HIV and AIDS, works towards the elimination of HIV infection and its stigma in Alaskan communities. Joining us today from the Alaskan AIDS Assistance Association is the Executive Director, Ms. Robin Lutz. Ms. Lutz, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. And you can also join our conversation. Do you have a question about how to get tested for HIV? Do you want to know who should be tested and how often? Have you been affected by HIV and you're seeking help? Call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752, in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Now, today we were supposed to also be joined by Mr. James Hoagland, the Director of Client Resources and Southeast Programs, but he is ill and won't be with us, and we hope he feels better very soon. But Ms. Lutz, we are very confident that you'll be able to enlighten us today about thriving with HIV in Alaska. So let's get to know you, and I would like to know about what prompted your involvement in the Alaskan AIDS Assistance Association.
Great. So I entered HIV at a time when things were changing really rapidly. I started volunteering at a small, back then called Gay and Lesbian Center in Southeast Ohio, where I went to college, in 96. And so that was right when cocktails came out but weren't accessible to all. So there was still a lot of death. And that experience connected me to HIV in a lot of ways. You know, as someone from the queer community, I saw the impact on my own community. I also just felt a way to be involved in something that was really important and happening around me to people I love, people in my family. And so I never left and spent most of my career growing up in HIV in New York City. I got my master's at City University there, and came up to Alaska in 2011 and have played a number of roles at 4-A's. I've started as a volunteer, eventually joined the board, became a donor, joined staff, and then in 2020, right before the pandemic, I joined as the ED.
Wow. Well, that is intense, working and studying in New York City during the early stages, the early times of HIV, and certainly learned so much. Have you seen the progression that we've had over these last 30, 40 years?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's been, things have changed so quickly. And I think one of the things that's sometimes difficult is for those of us really in the work and in the community to kind of keep up and emotionally adjust and mentally adjust to the changes, especially in HIV treatment and prevention. In 2012, we got PrEP, which is pre-exposure prophylactic. And that's the once-a-day pill you can take to prevent contracting HIV. And that was a game changer in so many ways. It was the biggest game changer since the cocktails came out in 96. And then in 2018, we accepted the science of U equals U, which is undetectable equals untransmittable, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. But, you know, as these things have happened, the discussions and the conversations in the community and watching the evolution of people learn to negotiate sex and drug use differently and supporting them to do that has been both really exciting and really, it's a wonderful collaborative process that I really enjoy being part of.
Wow. Well, you mentioned PrEP, and I've seen the commercials that talk about that medication. Now, is that for someone that's been exposed or knows that they've had an exposure, or is that for someone that maybe is in a relationship with someone that takes this, that is affected by HIV, and is this something that they can take lifelong?
Oh, that's a great question. So for someone who had an exposure or suspects they had an exposure to HIV, they would mostly, usually through an emergency room, access post-exposure prophylactics, which is called PEP. And for someone who is wanting to reduce their transmission, their risk of transmission of HIV to really 0%, you can take PrEP, which is pre-exposure prophylactic, in one of two ways. You can take a daily pill, or you can now do, just got approved by the FDA last year, a long-acting injectable, which is after the first 2 months, you get that injection every 2 months with regular HIV testing. And this is really a huge opportunity for really anyone who is sexually active or sexually active with someone who is using intravenous drugs or using intravenous drugs themselves. It gives you an opportunity to have conversations and have sex where you can choose things other than condom use, which has been our only tool really for the previous 30 years. And it's, you know, it's less about whether you're in a relationship with someone who may or may not be HIV positive and more about having the power to take control over your own, you know, sexual activity and the choices you want to make and be able to communicate that with people. I think that's one of the things we always talk about is, you know, this is about communication and negotiation and being on PrEP is another thing that lets you know where you stand and what your own risk, you know, what you're comfortable with and what you want to do. But it's a great, great tool. I think, you know, condoms have been great and we offer them and they work for a lot of people. They do not work for everybody. PrEP does not work for everybody. So to have choices is pretty incredible. And it lets people really figure out what works for them and then have less, you know, no one wants to go into a sexual encounter with stress and anxiety, and everything that we can do to reduce that, make people feel happy and healthy, is always a plus.
Absolutely. Well, that has certainly changed the face of HIV and AIDS. And that's really what we advocate in all areas of healthcare, really, is to educate yourself and to have control.
Absolutely.
And it's good. And we lose control in so many situations in life, right? So this is a way where we can take that back. I like that. Well, tell me more about Alaskan AIDS Assistance Association, or it's referred to as well as 4AAs, right?
That's right. Okay. Yeah. We have been around since 1985, formed back then like many HIV organizations were, with volunteers in the beginning who were losing people or were personally affected by HIV. And we've grown into a strong nonprofit that serves the entire state. We have a satellite office in Juneau, Alaska, and we're super thrilled to be opening up a satellite office in Wasilla in December, specifically for our syringe access program. Our main office is in Anchorage, and we offer services regardless of status, of HIV status. So what that means is someone can walk in our door and get what they need around HIV, HIV prevention, HIV care, no matter what, where their own personal status lies. So we offer HIV testing, we offer education, we offer case management and supportive services to people who are living with HIV, which often looks, you know, the goal of that is to help people who are living with HIV connect to a medical provider, make sure that they have everything they need to successfully access treatment. And what that often looks like is helping people navigate issues that are related to poverty, that are related to other systemic problems. You know, so we offer housing assistance, we do nutritional assistance, transportation assistance, things that help people live their lives so they can take good care of their health.
Right, and now people can live long and healthy lives with HIV, and especially if they're able to have access to the treatments and to these services. I think important to repeat is that you do not have to be HIV positive or be affected by AIDS to come and take part in the services that you have to offer surrounding HIV and AIDS.
Absolutely. One of our most popular services and one of the most needed services in the state is our syringe access program, which provides people who inject drugs with clean syringes and other harm reduction materials so that they can use in a safer way, reduce their risk, get tested for HIV if they wish to, and just get some good non-judgmental information and harm reduction counseling. And I'm sure we'll talk about that more. But, you know, our goal is to really both prevent the transmission of HIV and to support people, whether they are wanting to know their status, they already know their status, and they're just looking to take care of their health.
So someone that's been recently diagnosed, are you maybe the second stop that they make?
Often, yes. If they don't initially come to us and get tested positive, then we often get referrals from local providers or the state of Alaska, which collects HIV data for the state. And our main goal with that person is to make sure that they feel like they have the information that they need around a new diagnosis, which is obviously a really huge event in someone's life, and make sure they have what they need for that. Help them connect to HIV medical care. The science is really clear now that the sooner someone can get on treatment, the better their outcomes are. And, you know, there's a lot to unpack at a positive test. And sometimes that can be a difficult thing to kind of go to first for someone. And so we see our role as assistance in helping someone understand the benefits of going on treatment, talk about barriers to it, make sure they have the social and emotional support they need through that diagnosis, and then help them connect to that medical care and stay with it.
I'm thinking about where people are getting tested, and I'm thinking, let's say someone comes to my GYN office and they're getting tested, and I am not familiar with the treatments or where to go, so I would refer them to another provider that treats HIV. But this is great for providers such as myself to know that also we can refer to your organization so that it can work at the same time getting all of the care that they need and not having it piecemeal.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Well, some of us may not be aware really about the changes in HIV or what exactly is HIV and what is AIDS. So can you re-educate us about that?
Absolutely. And it's true, there's very little education now compared to what there used to be in the 90s, especially when I talk to especially younger people. They're not getting it in school, and actually not often. We have some first-year medical students volunteering with us right now, and it's, I think, a half day. You know, so we're in a really different place. So we really try to do a lot of education. But so HIV, it's a virus that attacks the body's immune system, and if not treated, can lead to AIDS, which stands for acquired immunodeficiency syndrome. So currently HIV does not have a cure. There has been some cases, which you might have read about, of folks who have received bone marrow transplants as part of cancer treatment who have effectively cleared HIV from their body.
Amazing.
But yes, amazing. Mm-hmm. Amazing. But also not replicable for the general population for a lot of reasons that I totally don't understand because I'm not a physician. But I know they're there. You know, one of them is just that that's such an intense experience for someone who's also really sick, and very expensive and very invasive, and not known if it's actually effective for other people who are positive.
Not accessible for everyone.
Accessible, no. So what we have right now is medical care and treatment, which is for most people one pill a day with few side effects. And that would be a treatment that they would take for life until we either do have a cure or treatment changes. The alternative right now that is also newer is injectable long-term acting HIV treatment, which is great, especially in Alaska. You know, we have a lot of us who do seasonal work. We're out somewhere else, not in a hub community. So to have the option of an injectable once or every 2 months can really work for some people. So it's great to have that option for people who might, something about a once-a-day pill does not work for them. So as always, like, choices are great. So it's nice to have another tool.
Right. Well, what are some of the symptoms of HIV? I know in medical school a while back, they talked about the symptom of a flu-like symptoms at the beginning of infection. But as it goes along, what happens if we're not treated?
Sure. So acute infection, people will often experience flu-like symptoms. Night sweats has long been considered like kind of a hallmark possible symptom. It's absolutely possible to be totally asymptomatic. an infection and not know. But what will eventually happen for most people who contract HIV who aren't able to access treatment is what will happen is they're more likely to contract opportunistic infections, which means their immune system is being attacked by the virus, and they'll, you know, be more susceptible to things like currently like COVID or monkeypox. And like anyone with a compromised immune system, you're at risk to become more ill than the average person when faced with even something like flu or the common cold.
That makes sense. Well, how do we transmit HIV?
Sure. So HIV is mostly transmitted through either sex or sharing needles. So the most common ways to transmit would be anal or vaginal sex. And then the next one would be sharing any kind of injection equipment.
Okay. And so I think probably important to talk about that it's not spread airborne or by touching. What are some of the other myths out there with HIV transmission? But really, it's an exchange of the fluids.
That's right. So there has to be a bodily fluid that can carry HIV, and there's only a few. Blood, semen, pre-seminal fluid, rectal fluids, vaginal fluids, breast milk. And then there has to be a mucous membrane for those fluids to travel through. So the most common mucous membranes or damaged tissue, you know, are places like your rectum, your vagina, your penis, your mouth, places where you're more likely to contract also other STIs.
Okay. I like how you mentioned the pre-seminal fluid. So that's important when we're just, I mean, of course, I'm always talking about intimacy experiences. So prior to ejaculation, there are fluids that are exchanged.
Yeah, that's right. Although the science has shown the risk of contracting HIV through oral sex is very, very low. It's considered a very low risk activity. So, you know, as I said before, it's much more likely that mucous membranes in the anus or the vagina is where transmission is most likely to occur.
Okay. And then that transition from HIV to AIDS, that is, do we see that even in people who are treated for HIV, that they develop AIDS? Or is that only those with HIV that do not receive treatment?
Oh, that's a great question. It can be both. People develop resistances to HIV treatment for a variety of reasons. We've definitely had folks that have maybe a co-occurring health condition that might cause interruption in treatment. I'm thinking of things like cancer. Another big health event, but you know, eventually with if the medications aren't working, then you could develop an AIDS diagnosis. And the way that's measured is that there's two markers that physicians look at when they're monitoring HIV: a viral load, which is the amount of HIV in your body, and then your CD4 count, which is the amount of, it's a measurement of antibodies that protect your immune system. And for folks who have a CD4 count that drops below 200, that's considered an AIDS diagnosis. But the positive part of that is that someone could drop below 200 and switch up meds, have another health condition resolve, get into care, and shoot back up again. Viral load can go way down, CD4 can go back up. And although that AIDS diagnosis will always be on a medical record and considered to have an AIDS status, that doesn't mean that their health can't really improve and they can live a great quality of life after that. So just a negative health event doesn't necessarily mean anything like it used to in the 80s and 90s.
Wow. So that CD4 count may go back up to a normal level, but they'll have the diagnosis because they've had it at one time.
That's right.
Okay. Well, so I've read that about 38 million people are living with HIV globally, and about 1.2 million of these are in the U.S. So our incidence in the U.S. has certainly decreased, although it hasn't been eliminated. So I'm imagining that in areas where there's less access to care, they're going to have higher incidences of HIV. So all of these programs that you're instituting at Alaska AIDS Assistance Association are things to continue to decrease the incidence here in Alaska, and other organizations that are similar around the country are decreasing that incidence. The thing is, I'm thinking globally, we have to decrease everywhere in order to get closer to that elimination of disease. So that's kind of a daunting task in my mind.
Yeah, we tend to really focus on state levels in the United States, which, you know, I think is fine. It gives us something to to shoot for, I guess. You know, in Alaska, it's
work
interesting.
To do.
Exactly. It gives us specific work to do. I think in Alaska, the conversation is interesting because we are considered a low incident state. And I think you said in your intro, you know, we usually have around 700 people living with HIV in the state. But we also, that's not a static number. So we, you know, as everyone knows, we have a lot of people that come in and out of our state all the time, which is wonderful. It supports our tourism economy. It's there. That's wonderful. And it also means that we have sort of a different situation than maybe Idaho does, which is also a low incidence state, right? So we see on an average between like 15 and 30 people who seroconvert or test HIV positive for the first time in Alaska every year. So we always, you know, things are always happening here. One of the things that is important when we're talking about low incidence states is that there's also reasons why we're low incidence other than just being small. And it's thanks to like the work of our community that we remain in a low incidence state. So there's the individual effort of people who are doing what they can to keep themselves healthy, regardless of their HIV status. There's the work of big systems like our incredible IHS system up here, who are doing good prevention work in the community. And there's also, we have a state that supports syringe access. So unlike what we saw in Indiana a couple years ago, when there was an HIV outbreak in a city that did not have access to clean injection drug supplies, here we have that, and it might not be accessible for all Alaskans, but at least it's available in our hub communities, and that that is a huge tool in preventing the transmission of HIV and helping people stay safe. So those things all together help keep us low incidence, and that's important for people to know that it's not just like we don't have HIV in Alaska, it's just like we do a really good job as Alaskans of trying to navigate through whatever our sero status is, supporting each other and trying to access things that help us live healthy lives.
Yes, and so we need to continue to do that work.
Yes, we do.
So we're not
sliding
backwards. Well, you've shared so much about the advancements in treatments and that there are less people being diagnosed today. Does the stigma of HIV still exist?
Absolutely. I think stigma is probably the biggest barrier people in Alaska face. And it goes back to a lot of things. We talked before about lack of education. You know, we don't talk about HIV enough, and definitely as a state and as a society, we don't talk about sex enough. So we have a health condition that is stigmatized, and then we have a health condition with transmission modes that are also heavily stigmatized, whether it's sex or drug use. People don't talk about those things. We have a lot of judgment about how people navigate those two things in their lives. And that makes it really difficult to communicate with other people about your HIV status.
Yeah.
We have many, many people who access services with us. And the situation is that only their doctor and 4-A's knows. And that's a really isolating place to be when you're trying to navigate a health condition.
Right, absolutely. You think about something like cancer or breast cancer, where you let people in and you tell them so that you can have the support of a family and friends and community that are supporting you. So I can only imagine feeling isolated and alone.
Absolutely.
Well, we have to take our first break, but when we return, we'll talk a little bit more about this and the stigma of HIV. You are listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. If you have a question or comment for our guest today, give us a call statewide at 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752, or in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. After this short break, we will continue our discussion about HIV/AIDS in Alaska with Ms. Robin Lutz as Line 1 continues statewide.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line 1 on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support.
Welcome back to Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. I'm joined today by guest Ms. Robin Lutz, Executive Director, who works to provide services that empower individuals living with HIV and AIDS and to reduce the stigma of HIV in Alaskan communities through her work at the Alaskan AIDS Assistance Association. Do you have questions about how often people should be tested for HIV? Are you curious about testing sites? Are you considering treatment options for a new HIV diagnosis? Call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752, in Anchorage at 907-550-8433, 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. So before we took the break, we just started talking about the stigma of HIV diagnosis and how people may still feel isolated when they've had that diagnosis. They may not feel comfortable sharing that with everyone outside of their, you know, medical community or immediate family even. So what can help with destigmatizing HIV and help to expand services?
Oh, that's a great question. So I think we need to get better as a state and as a society in talking about things that make us uncomfortable and that are stigmatized, and that includes sex, the use of drugs, being able to have honest, non-judgmental communication about those things, kind of across generations and across environments, right? And normalizing health as especially sexual health is something that everyone should be able to access and be able to tap into. So I think without that, we might not get much further destigmatizing HIV. As far as HIV itself, it's another thing that if we're not having the conversation, it just becomes something that is loaded and has a lot of prejudice and uneducated ideas about it. So I think, you know, when it comes to stigma, if especially for listeners, if you're not familiar with really where HIV is right now or what it means to have HIV, that's something that there's a lot of really good information out there, and we're happy to share that with you. And I think making the assumption that you don't know someone who's lived with HIV or that you don't know someone who's been affected by HIV is often pretty incorrect. I am both surprised continually and also, you know, really touched. Almost any place I go where I talk about where I work, someone will stop me and say, oh, I lost my uncle, or oh yeah, my cousin's living with HIV. Or, oh, you know, this is not something that happens to just a few of us. This is something that affects our whole community, but it's not something we talk about. So until we open up that conversation and remove the judgment from it, I don't think we'll get further in helping people feel comfortable and like they're truly valued as people, no matter what their HIV status is.
So we need to have difficult conversations.
We do.
Yep. And I think we are making some changes with these, you know, conversations amongst our family. You know, a couple generations ago, your grandparents or great-grandparents would never share anything about their medical health, or, you know, asking questions what healthcare issues are running in our family. They just didn't talk about it. And now I can see, you know, mothers and daughters are talking more about their mental health, their physical health, and sharing, and then giving power to that person to advocate for their health. So I see changes. They're just slowly coming. And so especially with sex and intimacy, you know, it's starting in our school system with our young people, and it's just such a, it's a political subject and very charged, mm-hmm. what you teach to, you know, people's children. And we know that's where education starts, is at young ages.
Absolutely. And it's too bad that things are, that topics that are public health related have become or remain so politicized, because, you know, this is information people need to live healthy lives. It's just not about judgment or about saying something is good or bad. It's this information that's really important. Like, you want to know if you're being ready as a younger person to start having sex, or you're trying to parent someone through those years, or you just have anyone in your life that you care about that's navigating that, information is really important. And having accurate information where people can ask questions without being judged or just get what they need to make good choices. Like, that's the whole thing that we want people to have, is information so that they can make choices that work for them, which might look different for everybody, but accurate information is the same.
Right. Well, a question popped into my head when you started talking about PrEP and the pre-exposure prophylaxis. So, is there work being done to create a vaccine against HIV?
Absolutely. There has for many years. And there was a lot of hope, actually, and a lot of discussion the second year of COVID, when the vaccines were getting developed for COVID, around that really moving all viral vaccines closer. So that's, I think, really positive. From what I have heard following the science, you know, we're not close to a vaccine that would be effective against HIV. We're closer than we were 5 or 10 years ago. I think one of the things that is interesting in the conversation around stigma and around serostatus is the conversation of vaccination and the idea of ending the epidemic, which is something that, you know, most states have a plan to end the epidemic, we call, which is amazing. It's a blueprint on, like, how we want to get to, zero transmissions and zero new cases. But the question arises of, well, what happens to people who are living with HIV when we reach that point, when we have a vaccine? And so I think that keeping that in mind is really important. I really hope to see a cure in my lifetime. Like, that would be, you know, that I think that's what we all kind of dream of. And I think having a vaccine would be incredible. And the important part of continuing to value and destigmatize HIV would be to make sure that the supports and things that are in place for people who are living with HIV don't go away.
Right. Right. Because if you do the vaccine, exactly what happens to those? So we need a cure, and
yes,
then we need a vaccine for prevention and education, because education is prevention as well.
Absolutely.
Well, who should be tested for HIV, and how often, who should get tested?
Yeah. So the medical guidelines are that anyone 13 or over should get tested for HIV at least once in their lifetime, which is great, because that really destigmatizes an HIV test, right? If it's a routine part of healthcare, just like any other testing. So outside of that recommendation, you want to be testing for HIV if you are sexually active and you think you might be at risk. You want to be testing for HIV if you are injecting drugs. You want to be testing for HIV if you don't know the status of people that you're having sex with. We know, which is most of us. So I think most people should probably be testing for HIV more than they are. And I think that's another thing that we just haven't really normalized. So it's pretty impressive to me when people walk through the door at Forays to get tested, because I know that they're really taking control of their health. It takes a lot to do that. And I love it when I talk to people who are like, yep, I'm on PrEP. I get tested every 2 months, every 3 months. I go to the STI clinic. I've got my STI testing done. It's like, you have a plan and you have taken control and you are doing it right for you. And that is incredible. The same with folks that are living with HIV and like are on meds or are doing other things to like keep their viral load suppressed or work towards health in any way. Like, you know, you're doing what you need to do to keep yourself healthy. And those are all really, like, those are all acts of self-love, which is great.
Yes. Where can people go to get tested? So where are you located? Where's 4A's? And where else can people go?
Sure. So in Juneau, our office is on Front Street, right below the Search Clinic. And in Anchorage, we are on Fireweed in the United Nonprofits building. It's 1057 West Fireweed Lane. And we offer rapid HIV testing there, which is 20 minutes, you get your result, which is great for any of us that might be anxious during that process, which is probably most of us, like any medical testing. And so we offer two different types. We do a mouth swab or a finger prick. People can choose. People tend to have a preference for the finger prick, which I find interesting because I'm a little needle phobic. But it's confidential testing. And it, like I said, we have a conversation with folks like, what brought you in? What information can we give you? Let's get you tested. And then let's talk about anything we can offer you to give you more tools and keep you coming in for testing, give you what you need to make the choices that work for you. And then after 20 minutes, we can give a result, answer questions, and the person can go on their way. And that service is always free.
Okay. So that's important, because what if they don't have insurance or something that
Absolutely.
Would pay for it, or mm-hmm. a provider, so they can come and get that.
Mm-hmm.
And for others, where else can they go?
Yeah, so lots of places offer HIV testing. The municipality of Anchorage does. Most health clinics will. Planned Parenthood offers HIV testing. And then primary care providers, places where you would normally get other types of health care, should also be able to offer HIV testing. Mm-hmm. And if you are in a community and you're not sure where you could get HIV testing, feel free to give us a call and we can get that information to you.
Can you go over again the ways that you're tested? You said the rapid test, but as far as, is it always blood? Is it saliva? What other testing options are there?
That's a great question.
For the needle-phobic?
For the needle-phobic, right. So there's three types of HIV tests right now. So there's an antibody test, and that is what we do at Forays. And any rapid testing, such as an at-home test kit, which is another option for folks, those are all antibody tests, and those can either do three things. You can do blood from a vein, which we do not do at Forays. We do a finger prick, blood from the finger stick, or oral fluid, which is a mouth swab. So all of those things will give you results within about 20 minutes. One of the differences or nuances with an antibody test is that if you're doing a vein blood draw, which you would need to do in a lab, those can actually detect HIV as early as 23 days after exposure. For our antigen rapid tests, what we stick with is a 90-day. So if someone comes in, and say if I had an encounter 2 days ago and I think I should get tested, I might go into Forays now and say, I want to get tested for HIV. And the staff person would say, okay, tell me about, you know, what makes you want to get tested? Where are you at? I'd say, well, I had this type of sex 2 days ago. I'm a little concerned about it. And they would say, great, let's test you as a baseline and we'll know what your status was before that. And then in 3 months, we're going to have you come back. And then that test will reflect what happened, you know, if you happen to seroconvert from that encounter. And so the other type of test is an antigen or antibody test, and that is usually done in a lab. And that can that can detect 18 to 45 days after an exposure. And then there's one more, which is a nucleic acid test, and I find this pretty interesting. This is for folks who are experiencing acute symptoms of HIV but have tested negative on rapid tests. So this is really rare. I've seen it a couple times, though, when you know, the medical people with medical training are working with someone and they're like, you know, this is really presenting as acute HIV infection. Your rapid tests are negative. Let's do a nucleic acid test because that will give us a very, very clear understanding. So that's the third type, and that's a, you know, not used as often. And that can detect HIV actually almost 10 days after exposure.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So very important to understand is that the earlier you are, or the closer you are to your exposure, you may not pick that up with testing. So these things need to be repeated. And I think some people may have that test and then have a security about it, but they may have been exposed so early or so soon before they took that test that they need to have that done again. So about 90 days for that mm-hmm. rapid test. But that's great to have it tested right then, know what your status is, and then repeat it and just confirm.
Absolutely. And we have a lot of people, you know, testing every 3 months is part of their healthcare routine. And that is fantastic because it gives them a point in time sero status every 3 months. And that's a great tool.
Okay. And for someone that may be in a monogamous relationship and also in not having other at-risk behaviors, would a once a year, and is that even necessary, a once a year testing?
I think there's a lot of variation there, and I think that's for individuals to really choose for themselves. You know, if you know that you are, you know, the only sexual partner for someone else and you both know your HIV status, then you're in a different situation and probably don't need to test as often. I think the key is always communication and just knowing yourself and knowing the people, or at least knowing what you need to know to make choices about when you should get tested. And so that's talking to the people you're having sex with, and also probably talking to a medical provider if you have one, just to decide, you know, what schedule should I be on, so that you get some input on that conversation.
And let's talk more about the prevention strategies and exposure reduction. You know, you mentioned with condoms that that's not 100% protection against HIV. Knowing the status, I mean, these are things that you should discuss in any relationship. What is your status, not just for HIV, but other STIs, and, you know, assessing the monogamy or that it's not there in a relationship. Those are important. What are some of the other strategies?
Sure. I do want to just clarify that condoms are very, very effective, 99% effective when they're used correctly. So, you know, you want to make sure you're really, that you know how to use a condom. We always recommend using lube when you use condoms. Really, we recommend lube with any type of sex because it is a good harm reduction method. So other prevention tools, right, would be PrEP for people. And then just kind of a knowledge of really what type of sex is most likely to result in transmission and what's not. But one of the most exciting tools in prevention that has really changed the game a lot is, like I said before, U equals U, which is undetectable equals untransmittable. And that science is super clear. If you are living with HIV and you are virally suppressed, then you can't transmit HIV sexually to another person. You cannot transmit HIV to another person sexually, which is a huge deal. And really, especially for people who've been living with HIV for a long time or, you know, the bulk of their adult life, that mindset switch of, there's a lot there to unpack for someone who is navigating sex. And so we always were trying to talk about U equals U a lot more, as much as we can, and then making sure people have support to sort of really digest that and figure out how they want to use that information in their life. So U equals U is an incredible prevention tool. And it's an incredible tool just for people who want to have, you know, healthy, fulfilling sex. And no matter what their sero status is, it's a whole new, it's a game changer. And, you know, the science is rock solid, and that's just super exciting.
Yes, very exciting. Well, how does that change the conversation that people who are affected with HIV have when they're undetectable and untransmittable? They cannot spread this virus. How does that, I mean, I'm assuming you're going to say that you have to share your status because you want everyone to share status and open a conversation.
I think, you know, I think sharing status is great. I think any communication around sex is fantastic. The more communication, the better. I think we also know that there's a lot of type of sex and there's a lot of encounters that don't allow for communication, maybe because of safety, maybe because of, you know, just the type of encounter. There's a lot of reasons why people might not share that with someone. But it does, you know, it gives us, it gives that person information if they do choose to share it. And I think one of the most important things to do just in navigating sex is to make sure you have your own plan about how you want to navigate other people. And so that in that plan, part of that is knowing your own HIV status and how you want to make choices around that. You know, knowing your STI status and knowing how you want to protect yourself from whether it's STIs or HIV, and being able to communicate that and also, you know, put it into motion. And that's not easy, for sure. So one of the conversations we try to have a lot is like, how can we help you figure that conversation out? When and who do you want to tell what? And in times when communication is not an option, what are options then? So it's all about problem solving and figuring out like what works for you and what makes you feel good and feel like you're following your own health plan.
Okay. Well, we do have to take one last break for the stations down the line. But if you have a question or comment for our guest today, give us a call statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752, or in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. We'll continue our discussion on thriving with HIV in Alaska when we return. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more.
Welcome back to Line One. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. Our guest today is from the Alaskan AIDS Assistance Association. She is the executive director, Ms. Robin Lutz. You can also call us and join our conversation. Are you wanting to play a role in the elimination of HIV and AIDS? Do you offer services to those living with HIV? Are you looking for services to help you to access treatments or education for HIV? Call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage at 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. So we were talking a bit about treatment and prevention and stigma. I think we should also talk about some of the communities that are more at risk for HIV.
Yeah, so up in Alaska, when we look at HIV rates in different communities, one of the groups we see the highest rates of are in men who sleep with men. And so there's a couple things about that. One is I think we've especially seen this around monkeypox in the United States. This is already a community that's very stigmatized in a lot of ways. And up in Alaska, I think we have one provider in the whole state that really puts itself out there as a LGBTQ affirming medical home, which is the Identity Health Clinic. But outside of that, you know, having a provider that knows and is affirming about like issues related to gay sex and queer navigation of life basically can be really difficult. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we have in Alaska, I think, to be navigating that and be working towards like trying to keep your community healthy can be really challenging. And so I think one thing that's important to us at 4A's is to be competent, right? And affirming when it comes to understanding that like we need to be able to talk about sex and sexual behavior, and we need to be able to talk about those things in a really non-judgmental way. And especially for testing, like making sure that for people who are, you know, more likely to be exposed to HIV, that that's not about identity. That's about just health. That's about keeping yourself healthy and having information.
You mentioned having an LGBTQ affirming provider or affirming practice. What does that mean?
That means understanding a non-judgmental approach, right, to someone's sexual orientation, to the type of sex they're having, to the people that they're having sex with, to being open to communication about those things in a medical setting, because it's super important. Mm-hmm. And then the affirming part, I think, is something that it's like, you know, the rainbow we all want, which is when it's not just those conversations are happening, but they're happening in a way that affirms your value as a human. And so it's one thing to go in somewhere and say, I think I really want to get on PrEP, and have a provider say, oh, do you think you're really high risk? Versus going in somewhere and saying, hey, I think I really want to get on PrEP, and your provider saying, oh, that's great, tell me more about that, right? Two different experiences.
Okay, that makes sense. We do have a caller that has a question for us. We have Brenda from Deering. Hello, Brenda. Welcome to Line One.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I was just wondering if a person with HIV is more susceptible to COVID, and I'll listen for the answer on the radio. Thank you very much. Bye.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Brenda, thanks for that question. That's a great question. When COVID first came out, that was definitely my first question. And it, from what we've seen, the answer is sort of no, but sometimes, like so many other health things, right? For most people living with HIV who are virally suppressed and on treatment, COVID seems to affect very similarly. But we have seen more severe cases of COVID of people who are HIV positive whose immune systems are not very strong. So whether that's because they have some other co-occurring health conditions or maybe a lower CD4 count, COVID experience can be more severe. So we've been very conservative at 4A's throughout the COVID epidemic, trying to really prioritize people's health. We are reopened to the public right now, but we're still requiring masking. And we do that just because we know that we have folks, you know, in every part of the organization that have compromised immune systems for whatever reason. And it's important to us to, you know, maintain the highest level of safety that we can. But they haven't seen a correlation of just being HIV positive and having a worse COVID experience overall, which is great.
Okay. And what about those that are then diagnosed with AIDS at that point where they don't have that immune system? Are there any studies about them having a worse case of COVID or maybe more, being more susceptible? I guess it's an infection, so.
Yeah, from what I've seen, you know, folks that have a really compromised immune system, whether it's from HIV with an AIDS diagnosis or cancer or things like that, have all been lumped in higher risk categories for COVID, been, you know, really encouraged to stay vaccinated and boosted, to really coordinate with their healthcare provider to talk about what the best ways are to protect themselves from COVID. So any of those conversations around, you know, I have this health condition, how should I react to this? We always say, you know, this is a conversation that needs to be opened up with a medical provider. So let's figure out how you can get in a relationship that works for you with the medical provider so you get the information you need about that.
Are there specific medical providers that treat HIV?
Yeah. So specialists for HIV are called infectious disease specialists. We have some really skilled ones in the state, both at Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center in Anchorage, at Tribal Health, and then with Search. And we have some private infectious disease physicians. So we have good care up here. We definitely have other primary care physicians who treat folks who are living with HIV and are, you know, committed to staying up on treatment and science and might not consider themselves an infectious disease expert, but are effectively treating people living with HIV. So I think one of the things that's important is, you know, apart from navigating the financial, monetary, insurance part of healthcare access, is finding a provider that you gel with, who you can talk to with, who can give you that affirming and non-judgmental medical care.
Okay. You share with me that in Alaska, there are over 700 people living with HIV. And are there communities, aside from the ones that you've shared, are there specific communities that are more at risk for or have a higher than average diagnosis of HIV here?
So HIV diagnoses across the state follow the same patterns we see with other health conditions that are affected by health disparities, right?
Yes.
So any community that is more affected by things like systemic racism, in Alaska specifically colonization, you know, generational trauma, lack of access to healthcare, lack of access to nutritional food, all those things increase a community's burden when it comes to public health issues. So in Alaska, we see a higher rate of HIV among Alaska Natives than other groups. We see a higher rate of HIV among in general, Black, Indigenous, and people of color, which mirrors the same thing we saw nationwide with COVID. It mirrors what we're seeing now as monkeypox has played out in the nation. You know, and again, those are systemic issues that affect the way communities are able to deal with public health concerns.
Okay. Now, you have an office here and then an office in Juneau. Are there any specific issues that are inherent to Juneau that we don't see as much here?
One thing that James has talked a lot about in Juneau and that we've seen for many years is, you know, Southeast in general, we serve all Southeast communities through our Juneau office. And in Anchorage, we have a fair amount of folks who really, like, there's a social and supportive aspect to what we do in Anchorage and people, which I love, you know, come in and just we'll sit and have coffee and just, you know, they're there to get some support and connection. And they're able to do that because it feels safe to them to walk through the doors of a place that might be associated with HIV. It feels okay for them to, you know, come somewhere all day where people know their status. And that doesn't seem to be true for most people in Southeast. The stigma seems to be even more isolating for people. And I think it's more difficult to sort of do things in person and be open or even just out and about around HIV status there. And now all that obviously might not be true for everyone. It is something that we've seen in general, just much less comfort around engaging with other people who might also be positive, coming into the office more just to hang out, things like that. It's just really difficult for people, which makes a lot of sense. The smaller your community is, like, the more you risk by identifying yourself as someone who has a stigmatized health condition.
Right. During the time of COVID, when we were kind of shut into our homes, we saw so many changes in healthcare, some for the worse and some for the better. How did that time affect those living with HIV or with family members that have HIV?
That's a good question. What we experienced at 4A's was really reflective of just, I think, what most of the general population went through, which is just, you know, isolation, loneliness. We've definitely seen a big decline, which is starting to pick back up again, in people's just sort of ability to re-engage, right? Which I knew was true for myself. Like, COVID has been traumatic for all of us. And I think for people in our community, especially who are isolated because they didn't have a lot of friends and family to begin with and maybe didn't have good internet access. And, like, you know, there's no, if you're isolated, you're really isolated, even if you're living in downtown Anchorage. It's really hard to suddenly switch, like, okay, I guess I'm going to my mental health appointments again and I should go to the doctor again.
Right.
Like, that can be kind of insurmountable sometime. And so I think we're all collectively still trying to pull ourselves out of that. But definitely we've seen that with folks who use services with us who are living with HIV, that it's been hard to get back in the saddle of kind of going about regular life because life has changed so much.
Dramatically.
Yeah. But those like needs to go see your doctor and take your meds and all those, like, you know, what used to be very normal and routine just feel different and harder.
Right. Well, December 1st is a day for us to come together. December 1st is World AIDS Day, a day to remember those that have been lost to HIV and AIDS infection. How can we get involved on this day specifically?
Great. Yeah. So, for the first time since COVID hit, we are going to do an in-person event at the Anchorage 4A's office, and that'll be on December 1st from 5:30 to 7. And what World AIDS Day often looks like for us is it's a time just to come together, and we're celebrating, we're mourning, we're remembering people we've lost, and it's pretty powerful to be able to do that collectively in person. We've done it virtually the last couple years. So there's been, you know, big benefits of that because people could kind of join us from anywhere in the state, and that was wonderful. But we really want to give people space who can make it into Anchorage to have that experience again in person. So we remember the names of people we've lost in Alaska. We share names of people we've lost who might not be on that list we keep. We have some time to listen to some music and reflect. But it's really just a time to come together and make sure that we don't forget where we came from, the people we've lost, and remember that we have a lot of hope and that things are not what they once were. So, and just doing that together is really meaningful. And information about that will be up on our Facebook page and our website.
And what is your Facebook page?
Mm-hmm. It's Alaskan AIDS Assistance, or 4A's.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you so much, Ms. Robin Lutz, Director of the Alaskan AIDS Assistance Association. Thank you for being with us today. Thank you to our audio engineer, Dave Waldron, and our producer, Madeline Rose. You can find more information on this and previous programs on our website, alaskapublic.org. Let us know your thoughts or suggestions by emailing us at line1@alaskapublic.org. This has been Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. Thank you.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.